people are really concerned about such things and what is involved with genetic counseling. Before I go into this, I'd like to first give a little background as to some of the ideas of inheritance and bring you up to the present. And then, in the course of the week, we'll talk about some of the recent advances in genetics and then prognosis for the future on Friday as to genetic manipulations and so on, which is probably where to get involved in wonder. Anyway, genetics is certainly not new, but the advances that we have today, of course, are quite different from what the early ideas of inheritance were. Man has talked and wondered about inheritance for some time, even as early Greeks and even before this time. They had a certain amount of knowledge of breeding for better progeny as far as animals were concerned and plants were concerned, and actually working with rice and some of these crops. One of the interesting ideas of inheritance is an idea so-called preformation. It's an idea that the new individual was already preformed completely in the sperm. In other words, they did recognize the presence of sperm in the female egg, but they felt that they thought the whole organism, the whole new baby, was completely formed in the sperm. And the only function of the female was to house the, in other words, the house for the growing baby, but everything was all completely preformed in the sperm. And they even claimed in their primitive microscope, which is not much more than a magnification glass, to have actually seen a complete little man right inside the sperm. And there he was. So the only few little problems for this theory was, number one, that what if the baby happened to look like the mother, how do you get around that? I think some people just thought, well, we'll answer this. The preformed individuals inside the egg instead of the sperm, that takes care of that. But there was a group of people, so-called animalculists, these were the ones that thought the preformed individual was inside the sperm. They were probably all men. And then the oldest thought the preformed organism was inside the egg, and so the race went on. But then it still, you see, failed to answer the problem, what if you see the middle children resemble both parents to a certain extent, and it failed to answer this. So two other problems for this. An elaboration of the same idea of preformation was the so-called encasement theory, in which not only was the sperm, not only did the sperm contain one little man, but inside this man, his sperm contained another little man, and so on, odd infinitum, you know, like Chinese boxes each placed inside each other. And so, one after another, already preformed. So it just didn't give much for chance, and otherwise, everything was all preformed, and there's no possibility of change. Some later ideas, for example, Darwin, we associate Darwin with the theory of evolution. He had a rather interesting idea of fantasy, however, so-called pangenesis, in which there are little pan genes inside everyone, and hundreds of these little pan genes. We had pan genes for fingers, for fingernails, for arms, for legs, and hair, and everything, and they're just all throughout the body. And during sexual intercourse, these little pan genes would migrate to the sex, to the sperming egg, and then the new individual would have little bits of, you know, these little pan genes. And so they would, it helped to answer the problem of male and female, that the mother and father usually both contributed to the child. But the only little problem was that these little things, you see, had to migrate to the sex cells, and then the organism, the new individual would have these pan genes for both mother and father. Little problem with this too. Suppose the father lost his arm in a meat grinder or something. He wouldn't have any pan genes for maybe a right arm. Well, then it would just say you have a right arm or not. Well, the mother maybe had a right arm, so you see that takes care of that. So the right arm of the baby would be entirely from the mother. But suppose she had to lose her arm too in the same way or a different way, then you're really up a creek. You know, no right arm, so no pan genes for right arm. And do you suppose the baby would have a right arm? Well, my guess that he probably did, but maybe they never came across this whole problem. But a person by the name of Weissman, I guess apparently saw the fallacy in this kind of idea strategy, so he figured he would try an experiment to see if he could prove it one way or the other, transgenesis or valid. He worked with mice, and he figured that if the minute the mouse was born, if he chopped off the tail of the mouse, there'd be no pansies for tail. So he did this every time a mouse was born, and he did this for 21 generations, chopped off the mouse's tail. And so there'd be no pansies possibly for a mouse tail. So then the 22nd generation of mice, he would let it grow normally and see if it grew a tail. Well, if it grew a tail, he would have to assume that transgenesis idea was invalid, but if it didn't have a tail, it's okay. Well, anyhow, you probably can guess the 22nd generation of mouse did have a tail. So this was the first valid proof against such a transgenesis. And Weissman suggested that the heredity was in the sex cells and not in the rest of the body. In other words, what happened to the rest of your body would not affect, in other words, your child. If you lost an arm or a leg, it would not affect your child. But this was in the sex cells, and here it was determined. Another idea that was in vogue about the same time as Darwin, person by the idea of inheritance of acquired characteristics. And this was Lamarck. I believe in this. And this is also followed through in Russia right up until the early 60s, this idea of inheritance of acquired characteristics. Here's the idea that environment could influence the child directly. In other words, environment was extremely important, and what you did or how you behaved would affect your child. In other words, if you stretched your neck, it would get longer, and your children would have long necks. So this is the idea of a giraffe, 8 leaves off the tree. It could continually stretch his neck to get the leaves off the tree. Well, gradually, it seems the giraffe has a long neck. And since we never used the tail, we lost the tail. We didn't use it, I guess, to swap pods or something, so that's why we don't have a tail. And an idea of use, and to use an organ that develops, in other words, if you practice, I guess, if you practice lifting weights, you know, got real strong, you also would automatically be strong. I'm sure you're aware of your staff that this is something you have to work at, and no matter how strong you are, your son is not necessarily going to be strong unless he utilizes his muscles. So, another interesting development of this period in Russia, a person by the name of Weissman, so you may have heard of him, head of the Genetics Institute in Russia in the late 50s and early 60s. And held to this idea of Lamarckianism, that inheritance of acquired characteristics. It got to be seen that characteristics, in other words, you could change the heredity through environment, but not only this, you could inject blood from a person, take blood from one person, transfuse it into another person, and you could change the person. I'm sure most of you are probably aware that we give blood transfusions frequently, and we don't expect to be transformed or changed because of the blood transfusion, that there's no inheritance so-called in blood. But Lysenko claimed that he carried on experiments that actually, you know, by blood transfusions, he could actually change people, you know, to characteristics. Also, he had this very elaborate claims that could be, that he could improve the agriculture tremendously merely through altering the environment. Instead of the elaborate and lengthy procedure of having to crossbreed, you know, for many, many generations to get a strain of corn, either what you're dealing with, he said, or just change the environment, and will automatically change the heredity and you'll have better crops. Well, course, for the first 2 years, or 3 years, it probably worked fine because they had a fertilizer and stuff, so they, you know, the plants grew better, but after that, there's a maximum point. If you don't change the gravity that quickly, you reach the maximum height. And the people began to realize about 62 or 63 that I think those planes were not coming forth. In other words, that his planes apparently were not true. It was rather interesting, all the claims that he had made, people in our country and elsewhere, tried these and none of them came true. In other words, that he had claimed we couldn't produce the same results. And scientifically, if you cannot, if an experiment is not repeatable, it cannot be accepted. In other words, he claims, okay, I can't use blood from a mouse with certain characteristics, another mouse and a second mouse doing these characteristics. Well, if this experiment cannot be repeated by another person, it cannot be accepted. Yeah. In other words, we can't accept, we cannot accept the experimental results of just one person. It must be repeatable. How are we to know whether to accept the test or not? So, no one was able to repeat, interestingly enough, like some of those experiments and get the same results that he did. So about in 64, he was finally, as he now has been removed from the head of the Genetic Institute. And it was, I think it was in 65 he was finally denounced. But prior to this time, they had removed any geneticist who even suggested anything as far as Mendelism or modern, our modern ideas of inheritance. DNA was just not mentioned at all. It didn't exist. Genes didn't exist. And they tried to completely obliterate knowledge as far as genetics was concerned. No books were allowed in, and no information concerning these modern ideas. Anyone who suggested such things, they disappeared into Siberia. Yeah. Result, 65, 66, and around this time we were way, way behind, and it isn't until about 68 or 69 we realized this, and what do we do about it? So they have now been visiting our country and elsewhere trying to catch up, but this is no easy job, you see, because they have no one in the age that would be teaching that knows if it's new anything or other than life cycle genetics, you see. So it's a problem when the government tries to suppress knowledge in this manner and the trying to catch up there. It's no easy job, not even catching up, but even to progress as far as any future research. But this is an interesting thing that did happen, and what could happen if a government tries to suppress scientific knowledge. At any rate, then it's up to Mendel, who's really our father of heredity, and many of his ideas of inheritance we follow, and I will give you some of his concerning the idea of genes and inheritance. In Mendelism, we have the idea of both father and mother contribute to the offspring. In other words, we have humans have 26 chromosomes. These are, in a way, paired. We really have 23 pairs, totaling 46 null. This is like in the chromosomes, which are the carriers of the hereditary information. We could liken the chromosomes to shoes, in a way. We have 23 pairs of shoes. You see, each of the 23 chromosomes are very different, but the pairs are homologous or similar, and we could think of them as being like pairs of shoes, in which pair number one would be boots, and you see they're similar but slightly different. One would be like that, and so on. And during the sex cells, the egg and the sperm have only 23 chromosomes. They do not have a total content of 46. There's a special kind of cell division that occurs, and it decreases the number to half, so you only have 23 chromosomes in the egg and 17 in the sperm. It would have to be this way, otherwise it's united egg and sperm, and each has 46, while your child then would have twice 46, so 92. telephone to them. Their children might have twice 92, and you know, pretty soon, by the time how working up from Adam up to the present, we'd have so many chromosomes, we'd be in the billions, and so obviously this would be impossible. So every new individual would have 46 chromosomes following some sort of misfortune. There are some cases in which people have 47 chromosomes or 35. An example of a person with 47 chromosomes would be a Mongolian idiot, Down syndrome. This is a piece of an extra chromosome resulting in abnormality. Well, anyway, we're assuming now that we're dealing with a person with 46 chromosomes, who so is the age of syndrome, which contains 23 million genes. Which of the pairs, the 23 pairs, goes into the age of sperm? It's a matter of two. And each one of the paired chromosomes contains such as genes or characteristics for various things that we recognize otherwise. For example, there would be genes for eye color, for hair color, for anything as far as we're concerned, for total development and otherwise. Absence of a single chromosome usually results in death. In other words, all of these chromosomes are important. They contain all the information necessary for making the individual and for his total functioning, for digestion, for all of the various enzymes, and so on. For example, a person with diabetes is lacking insulin, and here is a faulty abnormality that the gene are not producing the appropriate thing. Or a person with hemophilia. Again, just one little mistake, and the blood is not correct in clotting. It's not clear in the person to bleed. Or same thing with colorblindness, or albinism would be a case in which there's no pigmentation whatsoever. Again, just one little mistake, and the person is not blindness. On Wednesday, we're going to talk about DNA and how the genes do code this information. How is it possible that a gene that controls pigmentation and otherwise? And when you can realize this, you can see how fantastic is the whole setup that you wonder how it's possible. You see that it can be so perfect that just one tiny mistake can result, you see, in this abnormality. But and really how few mistakes there are. Going back now to this idea, there are 46 chromosomes, 23 in the egg, 23 in the sperm. And it's a matter of chance which 23 goes into the egg and which 23 goes into the sperm. These two cues and these new individual and new baby have 46 chromosomes. Does the child look like the father or the mother? Which characteristics does the child have? Of course, this is, you see again, this matter of chance, but there's some other things involved. We can symbolize the various things using capital and small letters. And Mendel recognized the fact that certain genes were dominant over others. And we call these things dominant, the others we call recessive. If a person has one dominant gene and one recessive, he appears as the dominant. In other words, supposing we use the symbol capital B for brown. Okay, capital B here is for brown. And small b is for blue. And up there be a simplification of eye color. Assuming there are two eye colors for eyes, it indicates you actually are multiple. But supposing there are just two colors for eyes, brown versus blue. Brown is dominant over blue. And so a person with brown eyes could be either so-called pure breed with brown eyes. In other words, both of his genes would be capital B. And this would be a brown-eyed person, and he would have nothing but brown eyes. So, in other words, his ancestors, all brown eyes.
Or we could have a brown-eyed person that is carrying a gene for blue eyes, but he was still brown-eyed. They never theoretically liked it. And if both of these people would be brown-eyed. To be blue-eyed, you would have to have both of those recessives, because the minute you have a dominant, you see, you're clear as the dominant. So to be blue-eyed, you would have to be recessive. And supposing, now, two blue-eyed people married each other, and what are you going to end up with? Blue-eyed children. Because you have no capital B's at all, how can you suddenly get one? Or, but supposing two brown-eyed people marry. Well, if they're both pure being brown, you see, you can't get any blue eyes out of that because you don't have any small bees. But supposing now, we have a different situation, it's the two, I guess I have a not let it see it. But two brown-eyed people married that were carrying the gene for blue eyes. Okay, they both look brown eyes, but they're both carrying the gene for blue eyes. Would it be possible now to have a blue-eyed child? Yes, it would be possible, because supposing this person's egg got the small B, and supposing this person's sperm got the small B, the two come together and you've got two small Bs, a blue-eyed person. All the rest of the individuals would be brown eyes. How many would it be? You could have this one combining with that, which would be a capital B. You could have this capital B with a small B, which again would be a brown eyed person. You could have this small B with a capital B, again a brown eyed, and this the two small Bs for one. So you have one blue eyed and two brown eyed. All right. Theoretically then, if this were to be true, blue-eyed people could never have brown-eyed children, and brown-eyed parents, of course, could have brown-eyed children or blue-eyed children, theoretically ratio 3 brown to 1 blue. Depending if, however, they are both carriers for blue-eyed, and you could not tell theoretically by looking at them because one is dominant over the other. This is an oversimplification, not true, actually, because there are many different eye colors than blue and brown. Two blue-eyed parents could not have a brown-eyed child, which is true. But supposing if both parents had green eyes or two either, then it would be possible, you see, to have a brown-eyed child. Why? Actually, there are many variations of eye color. And we now feel that it isn't one gene that controls eye color, but many genes. And each one contributes in a little bit of pigmentation. The same way skin color. Let me try to exemplify as far as skin color is concerned. You've probably heard of a lot of things concerning pigmentation and Negro blood and so on. Have you ever heard, I remember hearing this as a child, about two supposed white parents, one had questionable, quote, Negro blood, and therefore their first child was a jet black Negro. And you see two white parents giving birth to a jet black Negro. So is this possible or not? You see one parent supposed to have Negro blood. This is not true. There's no such thing as Negro blood. Blood is blood, and there's no difference whether it is Negro or white. But otherwise, it's all the same. The only difference would be whether you happen to be blood group A, B, O, or Rh negative or positive. And you could be a Negro, you could be Rh negative, O negative, you could be a white person, you could be O negative. There's absolutely no difference, and there's no hereditary characteristics in these blood cells called in genes in the blood, so there's no such thing as Negro blood, white blood, or otherwise, or blood being good or bad, or so on. Okay, back to skin pigmentation. Just as an eye color, there are many variations of pigmentation of skin from very, very dark to extremely light. And the darkest, theoretically, again, it's the idea of dark being dominant over light. But there are many genes contributing to the mutation. So we could give an example, supposing there are four contributing to gene pigmentation, but actually there are probably as many as 14 to 28, something like this. But supposing there are just four different genes making maybe something like this. Personally, I have really done it. Maybe I better use a different symbol. G for dark. So don't confuse it with the eye chart. Okay, that person with all, remember, with all of these are contributing to the pigmentation. This person would be very dark. And the next person with one small G, which would be the receptor, would be a little lighter. Two capital B's and two small B's would be a mulatto. One capital B and three small B's would be pretty light, but not, you know, the lightest Scandinavian. And then we've got three small B's, which would be light pigmentation, which would be a pale individual. Incidentally, this is all different now from an albino, which would be without any pigmentation whatsoever. In even your lightest individual, there's a certain amount of pigmentation. Blue eyes have a certain amount of melanin present. But a person that is an albino produces no melanin or pigmentation whatsoever. Extremely, they would be pure white. There's even no pigmentation in the eyes, and they would be rather pinkish in appearance and extremely weak and sensitive to the sun. So even if the person is, as long as the person is not an albino, there is a certain amount of pigmentation. And the amount of pigmentation will be dependent upon the number of so-called dominant genes for production of melanin. And the Negro, then, the darkest Negro, would have almost all dominant, whereas the lightest blonde would probably have mostly recessive. All right, supposing now we have two pure white individuals marrying, would it be possible for them to give birth to a jet black Negro? Absolutely impossible. How could they, if you combine two of them had nothing but small bees, or if you suddenly produce large bees, so it would be impossible. What about two mulattoes marrying? Yes, here it would be possible, because one parent could contribute two small bees, and the other parent could contribute two small bees, and you'd end up with four small bees of pure white, or four large bees and a pure black. So if you have two mulattoes marrying, you could at any range from perhaps pure black to pure white in the children. But most likely you would end up with something in between. Not exactly like the parents, but a little darker, a little lighter. But it would be possible to complete range. And remember that I am oversimplifying this too. There probably as many as 14 or even more genes contributing to skin pigmentation.
At what point
does
random selection
occur?
You know, these
different genes
combined. Is
it
like the way the sperm cells do,
or
the way
the matter of chance as to in the dividing. In other words, when these sperm and egg are formed, there's a division that we call meiosis, or reduction division. It's just a matter of chance as to how the chromosomes line up and divide. Yes, they would all be different, right. They're no two sperm are identical in this respect. And no two eggs are identical. It just happens this sperm fertilizes the egg. So it would be entirely a matter of time. So on. With respect to this one chromosome, yes. But, what I mean that no two sperm are identical would be with respect to all of the characteristics involved. Yes, right. Well, in other words, no two sperm would be identical as far as all characteristics are concerned. And then
which sperm fertilizes the egg would be the proof upon here as to what the individual derives. But if we're dealing with one characteristic, yes, then maybe 50% of sperm will be one type and 50% will be the other type. But if we deal with all the characteristics, many, many millions and millions of characteristics considering all the chromosomes, in fact, then there would be no one sperm. Okay, so this mentions a little bit as far as skin color and eye color. Remember the fact that I think the older idea was the idea that blue eyes and a brown eye, the brown child are blue, and no two blue-eyed parents could have a brown-eyed child. Well, this is true if the parents are both true blue, but if they're not, then it would be possible if this one parent could have sort of hazel eyes and the other parent sort of a grayish blue, and it would be possible to give birth to a child who had a darker eye color than either parent. It doesn't necessarily mean that they got mixed up in the hospital or something like this, or, you know, somebody could do it. So you see, it would be possible in this situation. Or in question that process for two brown eyed parents to have blue eyes, etc. Look at eyes sometime, and you can see some people have flecks of brown in more or less, and very few people have really true blue eyes. There's certain varying amounts of brown pigmentation present in the more when it increases greater amount of number of perhaps genes. We don't know how many genes contribute to eye color either, but there's certainly more than one. There are some hereditary diseases that follow the same pattern. Albinism, for example. Supposing two parents not the same parent, that their first child was not abandoned. This would mean now that both parents must be carrying a gene for albinism. Now albino is recessive to normal pigmentation. We should symbolize A for normal and small a for albino. This would be a carrier. He appears perfectly normal, but he's carrying his gene for albinism. If he's preparing another carrier, then it would be possible for these two small a's to come together and did end up with an albino child. What would be the chances of you having another albino? Again, it would be the same situation that I sympathize with respect to brown and blue eyes. That three of the children would be appear normal, but one would be the albino. We would have one chance, one out of four would be an albino. But two, half of your children would be carriers. In other words, they would not be completely free. One would be completely normal with the two capital A's. Two would be carriers, like this situation, carrying the gene for albinism but appearing normal, and one would be the albino. So if A, in other words, in a family, if an albino appears, then you would know that you would have one chance in four of having an albino. If both of your first child was an albino, does this mean necessarily that your next three children would be normal? No, it does not. In the string, you always have this probability of one out of four is going to be an albino. So this is one factor to know. In many hereditary diseases, the same type of thing follows the same pattern. One out of four will have this particular characteristic. And it may not necessarily be the first child that will have it, but once it appears, then you know that both parents are carriers. I suppose now we have a different situation. Suppose you are the brother or sister of an albino, and you want to know whether you're carrying this, or maybe it's even a worse disease. In other words, it may be something even more serious. But a hereditary disease, your brother or sister is an albino. Are you a carrier? We are learning rather fine techniques now, and probably in 2 years to come we'll be able to detect carriers, because we find that carriers are slightly different from normal. For hemophilia, for example, we are being able now to detect carriers of hemophilia, whereas previously we were not. A carrier is another genetic disease, you know, chikungunya. As techniques become more refined, we will be able to find out if a person is a carrier. And at present, we probably can't tell albino carriers to us. So suppose you know your brother or sister is an albino, are you a carrier or not? And otherwise, what are the probabilities?
If you marry in the family, this would be, supposing you marry a first cousin, there's an albino, that, in other words, your sister is an albino. What would be the chances for you of an inbreeding type of thing, giving birth to an albino? Much, much greater than it would be for if you were to marry in a population in large.
If you went to the genetic counselor, they would actually figure out what type of pedigree for your family. And it can easily be computed the probabilities of your giving birth to a person with this hereditary disease. Generally, the first cousin disease is 1 chance of 16 or 1 in 32, or even higher probabilities if you would have a person with this particular characteristic. Whereas if you breed in the population large, it would be something like 1 chance in perhaps 10,000 that you would marry another carrier and then give birth to a son. So this is not the only problem with inbreeding, so to speak, or marrying in the family. There are many, it's believed that we all carry genes, perhaps 8 or 10 genes, for lethal conditions, in other words, for severe mental deterioration or diseases that result in death within the first year or so. That we are all carrying genes, 8 or 10 genes for such lethal conditions. But we're each carrying 8 or 10 different ones, you see. My 8 or 10 are different from yours and from yours and so on. But we're all carrying probably 8 or 10 bad, really lethal genes. If you marry in the family, you see, the chances of your getting the same together are much, much greater than if you marry outside the family. So this is why chances of giving birth to abnormal children or children with genetic diseases is much greater if you marry first cousins or marry in the family. So they're interesting that in most cultures they are taboos against marrying, you know, our brothers and sisters or marrying great folks. And we don't know what is the origin of these taboos, but it may be that they have recognized that post-intermarriage is resulting in many people in session. Yeah, another interesting similar to sharing the Hopi Indians in Arizona. There is a history of inbreeding for many, many generations, and the frequency of albinos in this particular reservation is around 1 in 200, whereas in a normal population is something like 1 in 200,000, 200,000, or much, much lower frequency. And investigating, of course, this inbreeding for one, and then apparently even a cultural selection for albinism. And when we studied the area, asked him about albinos. Oh, we like albinos and all, but considered pretty good if he's a Bosnian albino. And another interesting thing, the albinos is we cannot go out in the fields and work because of the difficulties of the sun. Then they'd have to stay back in the village all the time. Apparently the albino men would, be congenial and visit with the women back in the village all the time, and there was much time for sex for the albino men. They weren't doing any work, and there was evident all thought of inbreeding, and they weren't really, didn't know who their brother or uncle or otherwise, a really weird concept. They would all be in this one tribe, you know, and they just clearly intermarry, and there'd be no division between the way you separate brothers and sisters and uncles and otherwise. It's just a, it was the other thing. So it was really rather interesting than some of the comments that the people would give, well, as far as the relationships, and this man would call me father, and I resented the fact, but then my mother told me, don't object to him calling me father, and then they'd go into this long debate about he was your uncle's brother, and therefore joined the tribe, and so, you know, for a while.
Would it, knowing absolutely nothing about this, wouldn't it also be true if you have a family with exceptional characteristics, exceptional good rather than exceptional bad characteristics, inbreeding would tend to bring you down in second and third grade?
No, not necessarily. In fact, probably not. We find that inbreeding results in appearance of so-called homozygotes, and this would be the a homozygote is when you have two alike. This would be either two small B's or two capital B's. A heterozygote is when you have the one dominant and one recessive. When you inbreed, you tend to increase the number of homozygotes. And this results in maybe some of them are dominant, but some are recessive. And many of our recessives are deleterious or undesirable. And by increasing the number of homozygotes, we necessarily would tend to increase the number of undesirable characteristics. The only way it could increase would be with humans, it doesn't work so well, but with plants, if you are selectively breeding for a certain thing, in other words, if you're selectively breeding for height or for certain things, then yes, it would be possible. But this takes many generations of post-inbreeding to facilitate this. But with humans, in other words, you can, there would be so many other undesirable things if you're breeding for intelligence, perhaps, selectively, and marry with somebody else who has a high IQ. But we're carrying so many deleterious genes, you see. And this post-inbreeding, you might maybe increase the intelligence, but at the same time, there'd be so many other undesirables if you bring together that would probably offset it.
You know,
yes,
I was wondering, you say that we all carry a certain number of wrinkles, but I was wondering if, you know, especially eugenics, in removing, you know, these types of individuals from the population, do you think that these wrinkles are rather constant and would reappear, or do you think that it would reach the point where evolution is probably just random that we show?
I don't say, as far as eugenics, there's two possible programs. One would be negative eugenics, which is to get rid of the bad genes by means of not allowing people to reproduce that have these, or the known carriers, as this was referring to. In other words, supposing an individual is a known carrier for such. We find it's almost impossible to wipe out bad genes because there's so many people carrying it, and you can't pick up the carriers. True, you could prevent the people that are actually deformed or have these bad genetic diseases from mating and otherwise, but there's so many carriers in comparison to the number who actually have the recessive characteristics that would be virtually, we find it virtually impossible to wipe out. Plus there's also the added problem of mutations that are continually producing, again, the same gene that you're trying to wipe out.
What I was wondering on, for example, you talk about fixed hereditary phenomena, but you feel, you know, on some of them it is fixed, but what do you think about the environment as far as the environmental influences on development of fixed
Both are extremely important. In other words, as far as negative eugenics is concerned, many of the programs of so-called positive and negative eugenics, this would be a whole discussion in itself, but in a way, putting money and effort on environment might be well better spent than working as far as the genetic program, because it would take many generations to try to remove a lethal, and if we spent perhaps the effort, you see, by using better schools, we could raise the IQ level much higher than you could by a positive genetic program, because it would take so many generations to raise the level of IQ on the average of the over IQ again would be the same type of pattern in which there'd be many genes involved. And to raise the IQ even 3 or 4 points would take perhaps 20 generations of selective breeding and, you see, put a little money in. You see, good school could easily raise the IQ more than heredity is extremely important, but heredity indicates potential, but rarely do any of us reach our potential in any of these fields. So here's where environment comes in. Okay, person may have a potential for being a Horowitz or something like this, unless he has the environment, he would never realize this potential and might remain perhaps never even able to read or write because of the environment. But again, we can't deny the importance of heredity too. I mean, they're both, you know, equally important, and we can't single one or the other out. Yes.
Is there any evidence, as you're talking about, you know, color, black and white color, two simple characteristics? Is there any, if you have enough experiments, any evidence of any of these, that there would be some other factor involved? Some of the sperm has stronger tails and sperm matter or something like that. Others, you know, that will result in a selection other than the two factors you're considering?
There is definitely a known selection as far as male versus female. We know that some certain sperm, yes, do sperm casting, that is, and this could be, in other words, presence of lethals could perhaps make one sperm less viable than another. Yes, there is definitely a selection of sperm too. Male versus female. Male sperm turn faster than female sperm. Male sperm do not live as long as female sperm, and there's definite selection here. And certain sperm are, in other words, the chemistry of female is all will kill certain sperm and not others. Again, there's a selection here. Yes, definitely. Yeah, there's so many permutations and probabilities that fit in it. Virtually, you see, all these factors. The female, the chemistry of the female at the time that intercourse occurs, the various chromosome content of the sperm is influencing here. And as to this, yeah.
What do you know
I'm going to talk about that on Wednesday when I talk about DNA, so I can talk about actually what is involved, how we synthesize it, and what are the, then go into this on Friday, what is the prognosis, what can it imply, or what does it mean as far as the future. I'd like to learn that Wednesday, Friday. But yes, it is possible to produce now a gene, so in the future what we can do with it, I'd like to save another whole discussion. I'd like to mention mongolism or Down syndrome as another example here. This is a case in which the person has an extra chromosome, number 21 chromosome, apparently a very small chromosome. If the person, the offspring, has an extra 21, in other words, 3 21 instead of 2 number 21, and then all the rest of the normal, then the person without the symptoms of so-called mongolism and very low IQ and improper development. Well, what causes this? We don't know entirely. We do know that statistically older women have a much higher frequency of mongoloid births than younger women. But yet, younger women can give birth to Mongolian idiots. And what actually is involved? Why should sometimes the individual get three number 21 chromosomes? Well, it is believed to be probably associated with the leukemia or the development of the egg. In other words, the egg has 2 21 chromosomes instead of just one. Normally, the division should be that 23 and 23, but maybe one egg gets 24. Well, why? What about the egg that got only 21? That probably, if this egg is the one that was fertilized, it would end up no child. You see, a spontaneous abortion, and the woman wouldn't even know where that pregnancy occurred, you see, because 21 would be illegal. But okay, this is not illegal. There's 2 21s and then a normal sperm and then the result, and this is why the child will be born, because it's not serious enough to be illegal, but serious enough to cause severe mental abnormalities and otherwise. But we don't know why the divisioning of the egg is faulty. We do know that all during the life of a female, that her sex cells are in the process of dividing. And we know, secondly, that a dividing cell is very subject to damage, radiation or otherwise. We know that dividing cells are easily damaged by X-rays and any background radiation. This is the theory of trying to cure or help a cancer by giving radiation. Cancer is a condition in which cells are dividing, and dividing cells are harmed by radiation. So if we can give radiation to dividing cells or cancer cells, then we can remove a good many of these. However, it's impossible to completely remove them all, and it's also possible, we know, through radiation to cause cancer. So you see, radiation can never be 100% cure for cancer. But if this is true, that all the future eggs are in the process of division all during the life of the female, from birth on up to the time ovulation occurs, the older the woman is, the greater chance you see with X-rays and all this for an abnormality to occur, resulting in faulty division. And the older she is, the greater is this chance of this problem. This is one theory. In other words, it's the age factor with the probability of perhaps radiation or some environmental factor, maybe just this process that now it's merely the end of, if she's approaching menopause at the end of the cycle, that causes faulty divisioning here. They're becoming too old now, and there's a faulty division. This is one possibility. Other possibilities seem to suggest a virus factor here. There seems to be, someone has suggested that a greater frequency of Mongolian idiots occurs during certain times in certain areas, maybe suggesting a virus type of thing. This we don't know, and the guy don't know whether too much work has been done. It's been one suggestion. Another suggestion has been timing in which intercourse occurs, if it occurs, if the fertilization occurs when the egg is almost ready to, die off, so to speak, then it can result in sex. The completion of meiosis, or this reduction division, does not occur until fertilization. In other words, the completion of this dividing does not occur until fertilization. If fertilization does not occur, the egg never completely divides into the so-called 23 chromosomes. So this could be another possibility, although why there could be a relationship between this and older women, I don't see. So I do not I don't think you do not agree with it. That's the other. We know that in some cases of younger women giving birth to Mongolian idiots, that in this case it was a hereditary thing, that she has a so-called planned vocation, which is an abnormality in itself, and that her 21st chromosome has been broken off. And this may have been through radiation, can cause breakage in chromosomes. LSD can do the same thing. Cause breakage in chromosomes. When chromosomes break, they frequently reveal. But you see, if the 21st chromosome hooked onto another chromosome, this causes what we call a translocation. And she can be perfectly normal, but her eggs will not be. One quarter of her eggs will never develop normally because there's a so-called, it's missing one of the 21 chromosomes. But another of her eggs will have this extra 21st chromosome, and so one-third of her children, living children, will be Mongolian idiots. So if the younger woman gives birth to a Mongoloid, it would be very wise for her to have a chromosome count to see if she is a carrier for this translocation. If she is, then one-third of her children will carry this, will be have this one-third Down syndrome. Yes.
Two questions were very intense. You mentioned what LSD would do to break the chromosome. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'm really impressed that that's not consistently proven.
Yeah, there apparently is difference of opinion on this. Some reports have indicated that LSD has not caused it, and others have indicated that it has. That's probably dosage is involved.
Yeah, it was my impression that was one of the tragedies, that the headlines came out or a lot of the testing was begun and the genetic effects of LSD, that the government cut off not only all funding, but cut off authorization for the medical, any personnel to be trained on any further testing. Is that what you
mean?
It may not be correct.
I think the subject used in this study too were people who had been on seeds and a lot of other things.
Yeah, and so. I think the experiments were not with some humans actually, and rather animals in the indicated certain doses did result in chromosome breakage. But again, we see this is dangerous. Does this necessarily turn in? And we can't compare dosages, you see, how much you're comparing mouse versus man.
Is the same true with regard to many of the normal drugs that people seem to not have course in their own absence, for example?
In other words, could this cause damage?
Yeah, but could it also be that kind of thing? Well, let's not necessarily ask another other regular drug that will cause chromosome damage.
Well, I don't think we know. I don't know whether we've experienced it. But it would certainly be possible. Yes, caffeine is known to cause, but again, it's probably in rather high dosages. But again, you know how much caffeine is sometimes.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on economics. You know, I mean, this has a lot of influence on how much study is done. For example, aspirin in laboratory mice, if you want to cause chromosome breakage, you know, aspirin is very effective. And same way as caffeine and coffee, hydrogen, stomach cancer, these type of things. But I think that the economic pressures, you know, put a lot of pressure on what kind of research is done. Like Cyclomate, which is done in mice, but they feel that a tremendous amount of pressure is brought to bear to the sugar industry, which really doesn't like the Cyclomate. And,
I'm sure you could prove almost anything you wanted against this particular substance. I mean, let's face it, anything other than what we normally take is probably going to cause a certain amount of damage, and you can probably prove it in one way or another. And if you want to go against the aspirin industry, I'm sure it wouldn't take long to prove a certain amount of harm in aspirin. I would be very much surprised if there was. It would be illogical that it wouldn't cause. Yeah, too much of anything is bound to cause harm. Even sugar, too much sugar, can cause a disruption of the metabolism. I mean, a little bit's great, but too much.
I think there's a real danger in medicine of the trend that we have now of going on the basis of mice and extrapolating to human beings because, wow, the distance there is so great.
And to compare dosages is impossible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in my opinion, the amount of sacraments that were consumed was such a low amount. I mean, I think they estimate that you have to drink about 24 gallons to really get the equivalent of what you're
experiencing. And we also put the answer into the
This is the problem, but this is so true of so many other things.
If you go to the medical journal, you'll find that, and it is in there, it's just been suppressed, that your incidence of stomach cancer relative to coffee consumption, there's a very direct correlation. But we have to realize also that the coffee industry is a very large loss of economy, and this necessarily has influences on how much of this is brought to life in the United
States.
Really good medical basis evidence on it, and really the number of people that are harmed by the reversal of this is doing a lot of really good things for people, and it's put a lot of people, potentially diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
That's medical.
Because a lot of people, if they could keep the sugar down to a low level, would never become diabetic.
Yeah.
But it's the consumption of too much sugar, and it's snowballed on the pancreas.
Right. Yeah, so because, diabetes is a progressive thing. It's not necessarily, it manifests itself genetically later in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's directly related to consumption of sugar.
Particularly if there is a hereditary basis too, but if you adopt children you have no idea, and then how much sugar do you let them consume, are they potential diabetics or not? No. But if any carbohydrate is too definitely goes into it.
Thank you.
It's the folks dressing into the board, and one of the ones in heaven. Whereas the one, the table sugar is a die shackle, it has to be broken down. It's another little giggle. You think of a candy bar as being, quote, instant energy, if anything but, really, because the sugar. And you think what happens, what that sugar has to go through before it's finally instant energy. It's quite a little bit.
You were mentioning that the woman was. Again, it's 24 children and so forth, has a good chance of one third of the children being mongoloid, and I think they were obviously skeptic and kind of programmed and so forth. But there is a good chance, rather than just one third, that 100% of them will be damaged, if you count correct.
Yeah, statistically, it's one third, but you know, it could be all of them, you know. 100%. Right, right. Each child has one third chance of being a mongoloid. You just might not hit it so good that all of them would be. And so if I knew that one third of my children would be mongoloids, believe me, I would see to it that I'd have no more children.
Yeah.
I mean, I just wouldn't take that chance. Even one in ten, I wouldn't be willing to take the chance. Unless you could perhaps have a, what they're doing now is they can take a chromosome count of the fetus. This could be done in this would be in my view the only solution to that. Pardon me? If I knew that I was carrying a mongoloid and if I were within the safe period of 3 months, yes, I would have an abortion. And maybe no one else, maybe someone else, this would be my personal decision, I would do this, yes, I don't know.
The society has an obligation to itself to take care of that form, too.
Pardon?
Maybe society has an obligation to itself to take care of that form and sterilize it.
Take care of that what?
In that case, they don't have an obligation. This is a discussion in that book, and I think it's probably a pretty valid discussion.
Mm-hmm. In other words, the carrier of.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps the. I mean, if one could be sure that one. I mean, a mongoloid, yes, would be the first 100%. Then here, I think it would definitely be. But if we could, if there was a chance, you see, of normal children, and if, you see, you could have the same chance in the earth. I think the bell is rung. One of those of you who want to stay, I'd be happy to. The rest of you can go on.